Okay, great. Thanks a lot, and thanks for the invitation. This is actually the first time at this Kavli Theoretical Physics. So I hope the talk will create a lot of interesting discussions. And please bear in mind, I have a lot of few graphs, so let's see. And I'm gonna be here until Saturday, so I'm definitely would be very happy to have. Yeah, right. Anyway, so all of this work, of course, is done by my group and the team. Basically, half of my group is now working on attosecond science, another half is still working on laser development. And basically, the key people here are shown here for the autoclock, the autoclock under the leadership of Claudia. And then we've also gone into the VMIS with Jochen and Andre, who has done those measurements. And the theory is basically supported by Alexandra Landsmann and the student that she is supervising. So the questions which we are looking at is still very basics. I mean, we've tried to actually come to more complicated target, but we always discover again that the atoms are still raises a lot of open questions. So we just wanna know how long does it take for an electron to be removed from an atom? And there are different regimes, which you know very well. And there is this multiphoton ionization, the tunneling ionization, and the single photon ionization. And there must be a scaling from one photon to n photon, and there must be a transition between the two. And I don't think when you talk to theoreticians, you get a clear answer. Depending on who you talk to, you get different answers. So I think this talk is perfectly placed in this environment. I've also attended a very nice workshop that has been organized by Steve Leone. And basically, the question was, you know, do we ever going to get some real time, real physics out of all the measurements? Because the challenge of this field is that we are extremely successful and extremely creative in coming up with yet another measurement technique. With the end effect that people outside of our fields are confused and have a tendency, and the bigger your claims, like tunneling time, the more they resent your measurement because they don't understand it. And I think to a certain extent, I think it is a little bit justified because all the measurement techniques are actually sometimes tricky because you have, first of all, time is not an operator, so you have to be very careful what is your observable. And then the next challenge is that you have everything at the same time, which are equal strength. So it's not so easy to come up with a simple guideline how you make semi-classical approximations. So you have a strong IR field present, the XUV pulse, the Coulomb potential, many electrons or one electron, and what approximations are actually okay. There is not even a common agreement between the theoreticians because depending on who you talk, they will tell you something else, which of course makes it very hard for us experimentalists, right? We're just trying to hang in there. So now, before we, I mean, ideally we would like to do pump probe measurements, but our laser systems right now are not really readily allow us to do that. We will still work on laser with higher repetition rate, enough pulse energy. So things will come. Meanwhile, we have the strong infrared pulse and the XUV pulse all present, or at least one of them. And so we need to sort out the dynamics with the more complicated configuration. And I will address now three techniques that have been used to resolve this ionization delay. These are not all of the techniques that have been used, but these are the most common ones that have been around so far. So one is the attosecond energy streaking that has been pioneered by Ferenc Krause's group, which is with an XUV pulse and the linear IR pulse for streaking. Then the attosecond angular streaking, I mean the autoclock that has been pioneered in my group, and where basically you use, instead of a linear polarized IR field, you use a circular polarized IR field. And then the attosecond interferometer technique, the RAPID, that has been originally used for pulse characterization, but then applied for the ionization delay by Anne-Lullier's group. And the question is, when we compare all these measurements, do we actually measure the same thing? And if not, why? And so on. So this is kind of the things I want to address, because we've made a lot of progress in our measurements. So first, I want to address just the single photon ionization event. So there is no tunnel ionization in this part of the talk. I will come back on the tunnel ionization, because also Alexandra Lanzmann will talk about this one next week. So here we're going to have an XUV pulse that ionizes an electron, and we want to know how long does this take, right? So let me just start off very simple, nearly kind of insulting you theoreticians a little bit with this simplicity. But I think it's worthwhile to remember what we know about pulse propagation, light pulse propagation, photon waves, which is also a wave packet. And we know that when a light pulse is propagating in a dispersive medium, they accumulate a phase, a frequency-dependent phase in the dispersive medium. And when you look at the group delay, meaning the peak of your wave packet, how this is moving, it is over a distance it, given divided by the group velocity. And you can easily show that this is the first derivative with regards to the phase. So this is the so-called dispersion first order. And if you want to look at the pulse broadening, then it is the second derivative and higher. So from that point of view, you can then take the comparison between the photon and the electron. I mean, the photon just has different dispersion than the electron in vacuum, if assuming you don't have a relativistic configuration. When you then look at the phase velocity in the photon in vacuum is, of course, the speed of light, and the group velocity is the same in vacuum. Whereas the electron in vacuum, the phase velocity is given by this expression, the group velocity by this one. And if you compare it with the classical electron, it is actually the group velocity of the electron. But the group velocity for the electron in vacuum is not the same as the phase velocity. So we have even wave packet broadening of the electron in the vacuum, which is different, right? And depending on when there is a potential energy around, then it just makes the dispersion a little bit more complicated, and it changes the group velocity. But you can actually also then define the group delay of this electron, which corresponds then to a classical electron. How long does this classical electron take from coming from set zero to set is given by this one. And this is, of course, the first derivative in the phase. And this is the reason why the Wigner time has been proposed as a delay. And that has been also applied here for the single photon ionization by Dahlström, Alfred Macke, Anne-Lullier, Joachim Burgdorfer. I think people tend to be in agreement here that they look at the ionization event as a half a scattering process. And the time it takes then for the electron to come out of this vector potential is then derivative of the accumulated phase of the electron wave packet going out. And it's clear this phase shift in comparison to a free reference wave is energy dependent, and depending on how high above the ionization potential you generate this electron, it will experience a different delay. So to a certain extent, you can say, oh, well, there's just low energy scattering phases, and that have been measured for a long time, and we all know that they're awfully complicated. We are now approaching it from a different way of measuring it, and this is done with the phase directly over rapid or the energy streaking. So when then we compare the two techniques that have been used for this ionization, the rapid, it is assumed that this time delays, then the Wigner plus a correction And in the energy streaking, you have the Wigner time delay plus a correction. And for a while, it was not clear if this correction is the same. But based on this theoretical work here, which co-authors, which are present here, who can explain that in more detail, like Marcus and, you know, so there are a number of people here, these two corrections should actually be the same. Okay, so in principle, when we measure the ionization delay with streaking or with the rapid, we should measure the same thing. Okay? And so you can visualize this originally, Ferenc-Krauss, because, you know, in the streaking and the rapid, you don't have an absolute time zero when you actually start the process. So normally what you do is you take a reference of two transition and you look at the difference. So one possibility is you take an ionization pass from a lower state and from a higher excited state, and then you do take the streaking traces here with a single attosecond pulse, and you measure the relative time delay between the two states, right? And or you can do it with attosecond pulse trains. Then it, instead of having a continuous spectrum, you have a train of attosecond pulses, which is then also a train here in the spectral region, and you produce then these sidebands. And if you look at the same sideband of the harmonics, you can also look at here at the time, the delay, and get a delay in the ionization dynamics with these measurements as well. So if you put that in more mathematics, I mean, the rapid is actually, in contrast to the streaking, is actually a perturbation. So you normally work with weaker infrared pulses, which is a good thing. So there is less perturbation of the device on the test. So you look at the different pathways in the phases, and for the emission phase, absorption phase, and you take the difference, and then you end up with this term. And normally this term, this is basically the absolute timing, which you don't know. So you always have an offset. And if you know the pulse extremely well, the chirp of the pulse really well, then you can access actually this one if you have a reference measurement, right? So this is the whole thing about the rapid, which was initially used to do the pulse characterization, where this atomic phase, which is the Wigner and this correction, was initially calculated and was much smaller than the chirp, and sometimes even neglected to measure the auto chirp of the pulse, right? Now we want to go after this one instead of this one. And so you actually have to be a little bit careful when you have chirped pulses in your streaking, right? Because otherwise this one is coming in. So what we've done is we implemented this whole ionization process into a cold frames. So we succeeded this with the first time. And this allows us actually to measure two species. Because it's in coincidence, and we measure the electron and the ions, we know which electron belong to which ion. And so we have two targets in there, and at time zero, T0, which is not known, we ionize the two targets, and then we look at one what delay the electrons are coming out. And because we don't know the time zero, but the post targets are exposed to exactly the same pulse in the same configuration, you can then get the time delay from these two targets. And you, so this part is then gone, and you can concentrate on this one. And if you actually measure it on the right photon energy, you even can get rid, you don't have to take into account the chirp. But I will explain to you what you have to do actually to take this one into account in the streaking. So what we do is we have basically a gas mixture in our Coltrane's detector, which basically measures the electron and the ions in coincidence. We actually even mix the gas as such that we have take into account the different cross-section of the target, that we get enough counts on both targets equally. And we implemented, so this is the Coltrims apparatus, which with the detector here, and then we implemented basically an XUV front end here in front of the gas target, which allows us to get the XUV pulse into the target, either as an attosecond pulse train or then as a single attosecond pulse. So we have a polarization gating that we can switch in. And we have an infrared reference that we can collinearly superimpose onto the XUV pulse with a certain time delay. And now you can say, you know, how can you get this one stabilized? I mean, we also have in transmission an XUV spectrometer so that we can fully characterize our XUV pulses and the fields here as well, not only the particles, but also the light that is going in. And we put a special effort in the stabilization of this interferometer, and we actually measured over a long time average, over 7 hours, an RMS fluctuation of 60 attoseconds in terms of the time delay between these two arms. So we have a pretty high time resolution in this superimposed between the infrared and the XUV. And then we basically do the single ionization, and I'll come afterwards in some of the details, right? We resolve the neon streaking trace. This is now with the streaking, the argon streaking trace. We can reconstruct it and basically get the time difference. And what we did after careful analysis, which will I explain afterwards, is the time difference, for example, between argon and neon. So when you look at it, as of this is the unknown time zero. When we look, for example, at a photon energy of 34 eV, we have about a 40 attosecond difference between the electron coming from the neon and the argon. And it is more or less in agreement with some paper that has been published here. Now,
did you go any further to the Cooper's minimum, where the
Yeah, we haven't gone any further than this one at this point.
Because most interesting happening in the Cooper's minimum.
Actually, as we learned, argon is a mess. So we are actually moving away from argon again.
And did you put the numbers from Louis-Lieu's group?
Oh yeah, I'll show you. Uh-huh. I'll show you.
Okay.
So we not only did the linear streaking, but we also did the rapid, right? And the nice thing is in the Coltrims, you can either do the streaking or the rapid exactly in the same target. So this is, for example, the rapid traces deconvolved from electrons selected with the ion for argon and neon. And we are measuring the delay here as well. And this shows you the argon neon difference. And you can see at, for example, 34 EV, it's more like 75 attoseconds, so we don't get the same. And if we do that, I mean, actually, when we did all these rapid traces, I was actually also invited at Anne-Lilie in April, and I presented the data, and that's when I discovered that they were doing exactly the same and were already preparing a paper where they measured the different gas targets. But they actually couldn't do it in coincidence, but they were very, very careful about their interferometer setup. So they used a totally different setup than what we used. And then we actually compared our results. And the beauty of the result is, this is the results now shown, what we measured and what they measured in Lund. So when you look at this one, the green is our streaking measurement as a function of the photon energy. The blue is the rapid from us. And the red is the Lund rapid. So within the error bars, at least, the two rapid traces from Lund and us are there. What we learned by actually from Marcus is that argon is little bit tricky as a reference. And so we also done neon and helium. And when you look at neon and helium, both rabbit traces, the blue is basically the rabbit trace here at ETH, and then the red is what on Lunier's group measured. And you can see here the error bars are first of all smaller, and the agreement is extremely good, right? And so this is really data that we compared without ever comparing anything before. We really had it in our pocket, and then we said, okay, let's compare. And
can you please say why do you need cold trims? Like in Lund, they don't have cold trims.
Yeah, because they get a lot of criticism. Oh, you know, your absolute calibration is limited, because the cold trims is of course much more easy.
We you don't need ions. You know where the lectin comes from.
Yeah, but to do the stabilization, because you do measurements, so you have long-term drifts. So if you repeat the measurement, you have to be extremely careful. And the Lund group spent a lot of time of doing redoing the measurement. So in the cold trims, you get it all at once because, you know, the difference between the two target. Whereas the people in Lund, they have to do one target and then the next
they
target.
They have their interferometer stabilized.
Yeah. But, you know, they get them from the reviewer. We don't believe it. And now, you know, we at least all... You know, if we do careful measurements, actually it is reproducible. But it's harder, much harder. We can do many more measurements, more easier. The cold trims helps you. Mm-hmm. And I'm not done yet, because all the nitty-gritty parts of the measurement is still coming.
Is it the angular integrated signal?
Yes, I'll come exactly back to all these challenges. So now, you know, you see, okay? First of all, the measurements seem to be reproducible at different places. I think we're kind of making progress in upper second science, right? It's not just one group coming up again with a new technique, another measurement where people don't know how it all fits together. The theory right now is also not totally in agreement, right? These are theoretical curves with different theory background, and you know, so they're all not totally covering each other. So here, for example, the theory seems to be in better agreement with our streaking results, not so good with the rabbit. Here is a theory which seems to be in reasonably good agreement with the rabbit. So, you know, yeah.
Just to say that you mentioned that the rabbit and streaking delays should be identical.
Yeah, sure.
But in fact, and with Marcus, we have said that, that was the low intensity limit of the striking we were considering.
Yeah.
Because the intensities used for striking are much higher.
Yes, I agree.
Not much, but substantially higher than in rabbit.
Exactly.
We did investigate the case where the higher field intensities.
Right, exactly. So basically, what I want to now go into is a little bit into all the details here now. Because obviously you could say, oh, well, the streaking is done with more intensity, and so there would be a difference. But, you know, the funny thing is the theory is in better agreement with the streaking than actually with the rabbit, right? Yeah?
Have you performed a streaking measurement for the EGR?
This is harder because, you know, it touches at this energy level. In the streaking, you don't get the full streaking trace because you get cut off, and so in the analysis it becomes harder.
Okay, and what's so tricky about argon?
Argon has auto ionization states and resonances in the cross section, which gives you phase shifts.
Okay.
And that can suddenly move something around, right? Okay. So what is next? Now let me go a little bit. I mean, we just got this XUV pulse and the IR pulse all in the cold trims. I mean, we can now do tons of measurements, and the stability is good enough. I mean, at the end, we just need to get enough statistics on the count rate that we can get good signal to noise in envelope in really taking the data, right? So we want to keep measuring. We actually have already done measurements on H2 as a functional alignment. I will not talk about this one here because we already have enough to talk about just with the atoms, right? And we got already some theoreticians to work on this one. So what is the difference? I mean, there may be that the IR streaking field is too strong, right? That is something that needs to be looked at. What is the chirp? What has the utter chirp to do on your measurement? How is the energy-dependent absorption cross-section going in, if you have one, if you have to take it in? What is the angle dependence? You know, normally people collect electrons over a rather large opening angle. If there is an angle-dependent delay, then we have already a problem, right?
But in your experiment, you have Coltrane, so you can actually set electrons.
Yes, exactly.
And you have to be careful because these calculations, they are specifically done in the Z direction. So when you compare with theory, you have to compare angle resolved data with angle resolved calculations.
Good, good. So I will show you that we actually measure an angle resolved delay.
We've done calculations for H2 plus as a function of angle, and the continuum part is very tricky. It's virtual states of the continuum, and it's very strongly angle dependent.
Okay, so I'll show you some of it, right? So you see, because we take in the streaking traces with a mixture of argon and neon, the data is totally mingled up, and we only can disentangle it because they're energetically pretty much at the same level because of the different ionization potential. And so they are, you can disentangle it only because of the coincidence measurement. So you know each electron dot, which one it belongs to the neon or to the argon ion, right? And so you can disentangle it and get the individual streaking traces. And normally what people are doing, they take a center of mass approximation to look at the delay between the two. And if you would do that, for example, argon and neon, you get a delay of 113 attoseconds. So this was the first time streaking experiments have been done. Now, the center of mass analysis is actually not a good one, and we can show you here how the autochirp and the energy-dependent cross-section is actually strongly affecting your measurement. So the autochirp means that the photons of different energy arrive at different instants in time, right? So if you look at, for example, the neon and the argon trace, where you look at 15 eV with the center of mass, these electrons are actually created with different photon, XUV photon energies, because they, argon and neon have a different ionization potential. So the XUV photon that are contributing to this one are from different energy. And because they arrive in different instants of time, this of course gives you an error in your time delay. So what you really need to do is you need to do a frog crap analysis on your data. And then you compare it here. And if you would do it again on the electron energy, purely on the electron energy with the frog crap analysis, you actually can reproduce the center of mass analysis pretty good. But this is electron energy, remember. We need to do it as a function of XUV photon energy. If we actually do that, take into account the energy-dependent cross-section, then the time delay is much smaller and even a different sign if you take it at the same XUV. And if you do it right, you get actually not the hundreds, but actually this correct data. So this is one important thing that you have to be very careful when you do the measurement. First of all, that the XUV pulses, the chirp of the XUV pulses is relevant in your measurement. And we could actually then resolve it and get the agreement with the theory. What about the angle dependence? I mean, we know that when you have a streaking field, you basically add an additional shift in the direction of the polarization, which is in the Z direction here, an additional momentum shift, and basically that distorts your data. right? And we basically followed this paper where they showed that when they did the XUV pulse characterization as a function of the collection angle of the electrons, up to about 40 degrees collection, they measured about the same XUV pulse duration. And so we actually, in the streaking measurement, used a 40 degree collection angle. If you go with much, much less, you just reduce your signal to noise, and then your data becomes very messy. So what we then looked at, we actually used rabbit rather than the streaking. The rabbit as a function of angular, because we had better signal to noise on the rabbit. You can also measure with the Coltrims angle resolved the momentum of the electrons. And this time it's not a continuum. You have, of course, all the sidebands and the harmonics. So when you then look at it as a function of the angle with the photon energy, you can then resolve the angle resolved angle dependence of the photo emission. So we compare, for example, this is neon. So we take a certain integration with here from 0 to 10 degrees as a reference. And then we move this.
Is it neon 2p or the difference, 3s min minus 2p? What is plotted here?
That's the, this is the photoionization from the ground stand up.
Okay, so 2p.
There's a single photon up, basically.
No, but before you showed the difference, 2s,
no,
2p.
No, we never did 2s, 2p because we only did.
This is 2p.
Yeah, I mean, it's just the strong cross-section when you come in with things.
Okay.
I mean, this is not like Schultz. We use just a single, not two transition
elements. So this is absolute data?
Yes, from, absolute.
Uh-huh.
Yes. And it's the absolute in comparison to zero angle, right?
And because you take it far away from the Cooper's minimum into P.
Yes, because we only go up to, this is neon, we only go up to about 30.
Why does it show such a large dependence?
Oh, that's exactly what we're going to, so I just show you our data. You are the theoreticians.
So, well,
so I, you know, let me finish here so that you actually then at the end we have a discussion. So basically what we measure is this. So let me just explain what we measure. So it's basically we take as a reference the opening angle between 0 and 10. And then we basically take other integration here, 55. So you have all these angles here in between. And then we can nicely get the difference in the delay for the different opening angles. And I mean, all I can say is we're measuring that and we're now in contact to the theory. This is helium, this is argon. It's a question of averaging.
Can I ask you, because it's hard to be, which one are the large angles and which one is small? Is the angles, I mean, these are the different angles.
Yeah, right? These are the different angles. So the blue is, for example, 10 degree, 15 degree, minus the 0 to 10. So the blue is small angle, and then it goes up to larger and larger angle.
And in particular, helium here is interesting, because that helium has this angle.
Yes, helium also has an angular dependence. And argon. So, in you know, we're basically right now in collaboration with the Burgdorfer group, and they are looking into this. But of course, this has an effect on a lot of measurement. If we have an angular dependence, a phase-dependent photo emissions, right, in angular, which is significant, the numbers are pretty big, right?
But helium photoionization is completely isotropic.
Yeah, you know.
It's a nice shell. What would you expect from a nice shell? It should be isotropic.
Well,
it's flatter.
But it's a, well.
That single photon ionization, delta L is 1.
Yeah,
it's a dipole.
So the angular distribution, the distribution of the spherical harmonics, sure.
Yes. But it's only one spherical harmonics.
No.
And it's one scattering phase,
yeah.
And there should be any angular dependence in this.
Yeah.
Because angular dependence factor doesn't depend on energy, and delay is energy derivative. When you take energy derivative.
Anyway, I mean, you know, this will be obviously more discussions. I mean, you know, the whole thing. You know, you see the error bars are there, of course, because we take a certain cone. But the whole thing is only a question of averaging time, right? That you have enough data count, and you can. I mean, this has been measured and measured and measured over a long, long time. It's relatively straightforward. And this is the result. That's all I can say, right? I mean, I actually think these whole measurements are always opening up. You know, when we talk about these small numbers of sub-100 attoseconds, you know, then we might have to actually take into account certain things that people say, oh, well, we can neglect it. But then maybe it is important. And by, I mean, all we are trying to do as experimentalists, provide more and more measurement, tell you exactly what we measure, and change parameters. And then hopefully we can actually at the end all agree, the theoreticians all agree, so that when we use one theoretical partner, we don't get killed by another theoretical review, which happens a lot, by the way, because theoreticians tend not to be in agreement. That's kind of actually, we're putting a lot of effort into reproducible, clean data. And so we need to have this interaction, right? Yeah.
So is the trend always the same in the within your error bars that it goes from, you know, kind of that the, it goes down from blue to red? From
yeah, because, you know, the blue is always the 10 to 15, and then it goes down to 65 to 70 degrees, right? So this is the color coding. So sorry, it was relatively small for you to read. But this is always the same color code on all of them. I mean, red here is 55 to 60, so there was no counts anymore for higher than 60, so obviously it goes down.
Is just positive time shifts, whereas the other two don't so much. They are
yes.
Negative time shifts, mostly.
This is also negative. Mostly, but initially I have some positive, right? Yes. I mean, and the numbers are big, right? I mean, look at the difference. I mean, it's not negligible when we're talking about time delays in the sub-100 attosecond, right? And then suddenly you're measuring this one. That, of course, also is interesting. Okay, so this is just, you know, for you to think about it. We're now able to actually measure this angle resolved. We can also do it in H2, by the way. And we have Martin already getting onto it with the whole calculation.
There have been already published results on H2.
Mm-hmm. Okay, then let's make sure I'm getting all the references and all your input.
I'll send
right?
you a couple of references.
Yeah. Okay, so the Wigner time is, of course, this group delay, right, of a wave packet. And the Wigner time normally is not an ideal time when you talk about the tunneling. So assuming that you have a tunnel barrier with a filter in there, which is very common, then actually your wave packet is chirped in the propagation, and a combination of the filter, then only a fraction of the wave packet actually gets through, and you can get an arbitrary shift of the peak of your wave packet simply by the chirp that this wave packet experienced during the propagation. And that's why the Wigner time normally is not the time, the good time for tunnel experiments. And also, as Bütiker used to say, there is no law of conservation for the peak of a wave packet, which is true, right, for a fundamental time constant. So I think most people agree on this one. Now, there is a very nice, beautiful Gedanken experiment, assuming you could do it, but I don't know an experiment that can actually do it, that you have a Dano barrier for an electron, and you assume that only within the tunnel barrier you have a uniform magnetic field, B, and it's zero anywhere else. Assuming you will bring an electron with a spin through this tunnel barrier, then only where you have a magnetic field, you have the precession of the spin. And so looking at the orientation of the spin, you then have a clear measure of the tunneling time. So this is a nice Gedanken experiment, a theoretical one, unfortunately, because I don't know how to do it experimentally, but people have calculated that. That's the so-called Larmor time. Now, when we measured the tunneling time with the upper clock, we as a function of the barrier width or a function of the electric field, so when we have now we don't have any XUV pulse. We only have an infrared field that is strong enough to basically bend the Coulomb potential, and we measure the tunnel ionization. When we look at all the different tunneling time that have been predicted before, theoretically, this is Pollack-Miller, Bütikofer-Landauer, which is the same as the Keldysh, is up here, red, right? The Larmor is down here. And the calculation with the Feynman path integral approached to this triangular barrier formed by the Coulomb potential and the electromagnetic laser field is down here in blue. And you can see when we look at the data that we achieved, we have a very good agreement with the Larmor time within our error bar and the Feynman path integral. And Sasha did the calculation with the Feynman path integral, and she can also tell you everything. You can actually explain all of these different times with the Feynman path in formalism, and she can give you some more detail on her calculation to this one. So when you then look at our results, a little bit blown up, so you can see these are our data with the tunneling time and the theoretical prediction with the Feynman path. When we look at it as a function of the barrier width, here of this, we can see that our time it takes is not faster than the speed of light, and it is faster, much faster than this Bütikofer or Keldysh time that just assumes that, which is actually a very trivial way of looking at it, and you just forget that this is actually imaginary. I mean, you can actually read Keldysh's paper. So this is basically the results, and we have had this one on archive since 2013. We had it in the Nature Review for over the year, and we had an out of the Otto Science reviewer expert who basically says this whole thing about time measurement is unbelievable anyway, and it's not right, and slow light is also not real, and you know, we had this kind of a reviewer. But I actually think it represents a little bit the situation of people who are outside of the Otto Science community. They're simply confused, right? Because we're coming up with a whole bunch of new techniques, and it's very hard. It's even hard for us inside the community to keep track of all the approximations of the different techniques done.
Can you maybe lift the confusion a bit and tell us what you actually measure there, or what
yes.
got it?
Yes. Okay, and I'll do that.
Maybe your result was Larsen's on that.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Is it zero because you said zero?
No, I'll come in the details. So I don't know how much you already know about the Otto clock. So basically, instead of using a linear polarized few cycle pulse like you do it in the Otto second streaking, we simply use a circular polarized light. So we only have this one, right? And if you have a few cycle circular polarized light, then you have the maximum of the electric field going around and then down. So your magnitude of the electric field goes slowly up and down, and you only have the strength of the electric field within less than optical cycle to tunnel ionize this atom, right? So at the peak of the electric field, you have the highest probability for this tunnel ionization.
So is that your zero time?
Yes, we actually use a little bit elliptical polarization. not perfect circular, because with the elliptical polarization, the zero, the start, which is very similar to this Feynman path integral, which is looking at all the different trajectory, and then looking at the peak. So the start zero, because afterwards you look over many, many tunnel processes, and you look then at the electron distribution at the end of the pulse, and you look at the one which has the highest count. And the highest count is the most probable trajectory, which is the ionization along the maximum of the electric field. And by going to an elliptically polarized light, a little bit away from the circular polarized light, your main axis is actually fixed in space, and you can measure that very carefully, and it's an extremely stable parameter. For 800 nanometer, 1 degree of what you're measuring, then the final momentum, so 1 degree is like 7.5 attoseconds. So you can easily then measure the momentum of the electron at the end. So this is your time zero, which is a measurement. And so when you do this simple one, which is like in the streaking, when you first ignore the Coulomb and the electron thing, you just have the electric field going around in the polarization plane. At maximum, here is assumed to be instantaneous ionization, and then you follow the Newton equation with initial parameters, the exit of the tunnel and the velocity at the exit of the tunnel, right? Now, the exit of the tunnel, that of course is, if you would neglect any of the Coulomb field, you can actually show that this is exactly 90 degrees C. But if you take into a 90 degree, and if you take into account the Coulomb and all the other ones, then there is an offset. And we actually went back, we've done a number of measurements on different targets, but we actually went back to helium, because helium is the one which is, in principle, the most simple one that we can readily do in an experiment. Hydrogen would be even better, but it's not so easy for us to do that as a target. So helium is close to the simplest one. And basically, in the single electron approximation, you have two electrons in the S thing. So in the single electron, active electron approximation, because we're extremely low electric fields here, we are having no double ionization, you can actually show that your time-dependent Schrödinger equation can be exactly solved when you go to these parabolic coordinates. Then your tunnel barrier is a little bit different from the simple one-dimensional barrier, which we call the field direction model. And basically, the exit in this eta coordinate can be explicitly solved analytical for a Coulomb potential and a laser field. And this is a textbook. Of course, you assume here a static tunnel barrier. So it's the adiabatic approximation. But I come back to this. So we use this one for our adiabatic approximation, because we measure basically the final momentum distribution in the coltrims. We measure the time zero exactly. We know exactly where the time zero is. And then we measure this offset angle, which gives us then ultimately the tunneling time. So the idea is, if we assume instantaneous tunneling, this offset angle in comparison to the 90 degrees, should be given by the solid line, assuming the adiabatic model with the parabolic coordinates. We, however, measure everything above. And we please be aware that the intensities are rather low, right? So here is the Keldysh parameter for helium at the wavelengths that we did. The Keldysh parameter varies from 2.47 to 0.8, right? Here. It's rather low, which actually means that this approximation in the parabolic coordinates is actually exact. And what is also nice, we actually do two sanity checks in our measurement. We can rotate the polarization of your circle polarization either clockwise or anticlockwise. So we just simply turn the quarter wave plate in front of the experiment, and we measure the data for these two settings, and they should actually, with regards to 90 degrees C, would be the same. So we just flip the anti-clock to the same order, and you can see the clock and anti-clockwise from our results are superimposed. So this is a sanity check that everything is actually under control. In addition, we measured the lower intensity measurement with VMIS, with tomographic reconstruction to get the 3D distribution, and you can see we get an overlap with the Coltrim measurement here. The Coltrim is harder at these lower intensities because you hardly get any counts anymore. And of course, the tunneling time is nearly within the error when you go up in the intensity. We always had this offset, but our error bars were actually much larger. So initially we did the measurement at 1 kilohertz, then we went to a 10 kilohertz system, which already improved the signal to noise for the peak search substantially, right? Because you go for the peak search of the most probable electron counts right here. This is basically this offset angle. Has a certain distribution.
Carrier envelope phase?
No, it doesn't actually, because we because the carrier envelope phase just makes the electron the maximum of the electric field go jumping around here. It gives you just an equal distribution around this one here. So you actually, you know, you can even argue you get a more accurate measurement if your carrier envelope offset phase is not stabilized. You get a much more symmetric distribution of the electron count around this one here. This is actually extremely well understood. We looked at everything as a function of carrier envelope. Initially, everything as a function, and then we realized, oops, it's actually even better if we don't. We get a much better peak search and much better fit on the peak for the search.
Can I ask something? In the previous transparency, why do you say that it's precisely defined with the peak of the electric field, i.e. the most probable trajectory, but doesn't that depend on the intensity?
Yeah, but I mean...
For higher intensities, it can be that your most probable peak will not be at the peak.
Yeah, but
trajectory
this,
will not be at the peak of the field.
But at this intensity regime where we are working here, this is generally the case. We don't have any saturation effect. We are far away. I mean, we're definitely not in a regime where we would have to take this into account.
So what you say, before the peak, nothing comes out?
No. I mean, there is, of course, a certain distribution, but it's a lower count, right? So basically, we have this data. And then when you look at this is, for example, a measurement that we've done with the VMIS. Right, the distribution. And this is the fit, how we get the fit in, and this is how the peak search. So the error bars is basically the error to the fit to find the peak search on your data. Okay? And basically, when you look at our original measurement was done over a much larger intensity regime, where the error bars were much larger than what we could do later on
so
with the more refined measurement.
The asymptotic difference roughly 400 degrees. It seems to settle, but did you try to fit that or something?
I mean, when you look at the original data, the tendency is that it goes to pretty much to zero. I mean, it goes faster and faster, ultimately. I mean, that's why we went to lower intensity with our measurement,
yeah,
so that we could resolve it.
Area, right?
Yeah, but we are far away from
far
this.
Away, okay.
Yeah, we are far away. I mean, here we are not even close in helium. But, you know, Sasha then can really give you more details. You know now all the questions that are coming, so you're prepared for getting all this one in, right? Because she did then the theory. Yeah. And of course, I have more data.
When you have the use of gamma, which is larger than 1 to 100 dimensions,
yes, and we don't see a transition.
Okay.
That's also interesting. Because, you know, we always, you know, you always have this multi-photon ionization regime, and then you have the tunneling regime. And we just, you know, we just looked at the theory, at this one, and didn't see.
The delays you are measuring here are not, cannot be ascribed to tunneling.
Yeah, but you see, because we're mostly working around this gamma around one, and you have still a tunneling behavior in the data. Yes, and let me go to this one as well, right? Because we are also still preparing to do the same measurement. For example, all these measurements are done right now at 800 nanometers. So we're building up a laser, and I will show you afterwards some more data as we go along. A mid-IR laser that allows us then to repeat the whole measurement, for example, at 3.4 micrometer. And then we will do that as well. Okay, so we just keep plugging away, right? And do measurements as accurately as we can. And, you know, and then we have to revisit our assumptions that
can
have
I
been.
Ask one more question?
Yeah.
So I can understand. So your basic assumption, if I understand, is that the electron gets out at the peak of the field.
Yes.
Is that so? Okay. Now.
The most probable. But there is a distribution.
Yeah. Now, actually, from my experience, it's not the most probable for high intensities, but
we are not at high intensities.
Okay, so that's what I want to understand, though, because am I supposed to compare the black dots with your red and your blue ones?
Yes, because this is.
But then I'm confused, because if this is a classical.
No, it's not purely classical.
It's semi-classical. He has the tunneling time, because he has the tunneling probability at the beginning. That's what he's doing.
Yeah, but it's strongly modified.
By the polarization, nothing else. Yeah, but no, but hold on, just a moment.
But, you know, I do some correction to it. Yeah, can I finish at those and then we can come back?
My question, well, I'm confusing it a bit, because then I don't understand why the classical, semi-classical model deviates more at small intensities.
Oh, no, this is clear to me. You see, this curve is assuming no tunneling delay. What would be the offset angle with no tunneling delay? And this is the solid line is the single trajectory, which is the most probable trajectory, and the dotted is basically a Monte Carlo simulation where you take all possible ionization probabilities and look for the peak surge on the data as well.
But my point is that
assuming zero delay
for small intensities, the approximation that we are making is more exact.
Yes,
the approximation is more exact.
Yeah, that's where we also resolve the tunneling time
why
more.
Why does it deviate more at the beginning?
Yeah, because I think one thing is, of course, not taking into account this is small electricity.
Yes, and I'll come to this one now.
That's, of course, more severe at small intensities because the tunnel exit will change much more.
Okay, let me give you my talk. Let me give you the talk now. So let me go exactly into this one. So now, I mean, if you put in the corrections, okay, so this is the things that we measure, right? So this is something we can most the peak surge of your electron distribution, the signal to noise is excellent with 10 hertz. So we can get this offset angle with regards to 9 degrees. And I hope I convinced you now that these are pretty reliable data because they have been reproduced by many different students now in my group, right? And if anything, we only got more data and they are reproducible, right? With two instruments. So this is the offset angle. So then we basically deduct the streaking angle, which is basically the 90 degree plus a correction because of the Coulomb, which I explained to you, which is done with the parabolic coordinates, and then the adiabatic correction, right? And that's where Sasha also came in because basically she compared all the possible theories that are out there taking into account non-adiabatic models. I mean, basically, the way I understand it, but Sasha can then explain it in her talk better, is assuming that during the tunnel process there is a photon absorption, then effectively the electron comes out at a different energy, and that's like having a different radius and a different initial velocity, right? So anyway, if you take into account all these different models, okay, the parabolic coordinate, then the tip piece, the field direction model, PPT, as a the barrier width as a function of field strength. You see all this variation, right? We can take all this, all these theories, take in those starting points, take in the velocity that these theories predict, and calculate what would be the curve down here that we would compare it to. Can we explain this offset angle with any of these non-adiabatic theories that are published out there? Okay, and so here is basically one that is basically the adiabatic, which I already talked about, right? Then this is PPT, non-adiabatic. Look at the small little correction of this reference line. Then there is all kind of mixture, which is actually interesting. Which is all the references down there. It's another line, another line, and another line. So this is never moving up here, right? And if we then take all this, because if the electron doesn't come out at the peak, then of course the streaking is not exactly 90 degrees, but that is easy to calculate. And actually the reality is, the tendency is that this is correcting each other. So the effect, when you actually go and do the correction correctly with this addition, with these different starting points, you get then the tunneling delay from this curve here, you will get this one. And if you take the black one, which on the other side of the curve, you get this one. So even so, you have a stronger effect in the lower intensity regime. They actually tend to cancel each other in the streaking correction and in the adiabatic, if you go through this one. And so what you see, this is all the data with all the adiabatic correction that are out there at this point that you use. It's within the error bar practically the same, right? And this is when we don't do anything. It's actually extremely robust.
Christian, we had a seminar last week with Armin Skrinzi, and he showed your data points and the solution of the time-dependent Schrödinger equation, which looked very much like Tsipi's data. And he compared his calculation with our published calculation. It also was very close. And this is time-dependent Schrödinger equation. If there was any delay, it was there. It's built in. It's very large difference with the experimental data and can be explained at any tunneling.
So they can. He can explain this. Well, I don't know. I haven't seen the talk from him. So he can explain this time-dependent Schrödinger equation, which is identical here.
No. I'm talking about raw data. No, any sort of post-processing.
So he can explain.
He calculated the angular offset.
Ah, initially when we talked to him, he couldn't, but so he adopted it.
No, he apparently made quite significant progress.
Not for helium, it was one antibilateral.
Singularity of electrons.
Yeah.
Okay, but with all the reservations, but then we sort of talking about different physics. It's
but
not
you
tunneling.
But you see, the time-dependent Schrödinger equation, people always say, oh, this is the truth. But you all make approximation in your time-dependent Schrödinger equation.
There is only one, which is single exponential.
Yes, and you assume a certain Coulomb potential, right, in your...
In our calculation, we did not assume it's an exact Coulomb potential.
So I would like to also talk more about this one during my time here, right?
Sure.
Because, I mean, I actually have lots more stuff than what I'm showing here, and I actually would like you look, let's
when,
look at
when
it, and Sasha is here the whole time, blank.
When we talked last time in Paris, he said, I have to talk to Armin, because he's the main expert. But now our calculations agree, at least two theorists agree between themselves.
Okay, so I will have to look into this a little bit more carefully, because the first time when he did the calculation, it did not agree. When he did it first, his data points were not the same.
So actually, you look for helium for two electrons?
No. One single electron. Yeah, that's always a catch. You can always say that.
Is one electron assumption a bad assumption for this problem?
Well, if you believe the data and the theory, yes.
But the tunneling, so, but you know, if it's in perfect agreement with the tunnel, with the time-dependent Schrödinger equation, then the tunneling time is embedded in there, right? You just don't pull that one out.
Of course. Yeah.
So that basically means our data is confirmed, but you don't pull out the tunneling time.
He did even more. He showed some beautiful results that if instead
I need to look
Coulomb
at
potential, you have a Yukawa potential.
Yeah. Compare the two, right?
Then it's all zero.
So it is, I assume it's online, right? When he did the...
And my talk is also online.
It's too bad. We have some time to talk about it. But you see, when you do the whole calculation, then you can't explicitly pull out the tunneling time because
We never talk about
But that. Then it would actually say that's progress because we're moving into some kind of agreement between the theory. And our experiment. Yeah, if the time-dependent Schrödinger equation can explain this one.
No, it cannot. That's the problem.
Oh, it can't. It's coming to this.
Yes.
So we have a problem.
But with a single electric electron. Single electric electron. So not for him.
So, okay, so we definitely need to talk more. You know, because I mean, we definitely measure this angular offset, and I mean, it is significant. Look at this. I mean, this is not little. Okay. So there's plenty of discussion, and I'm very happy to have this discussion going on, right? Because now we are all here. I mean, Sasha can explain that in her talk, right? Can you do that?
I can explain it in person.
I mean, it's of course, you know, I'm already way overdue on my talk, but you know, and I have all of the details ready, and she can explain it in more detail as well, right? But it's based on all the theories, right, that are out there. So, you know, these semi-classical models are being used at many other places as well. So, I mean, ultimately, we need to come to agreement between time-dependent Schrödinger equation and semi-classical model, because otherwise we're never going to do anything more complicated than hydrogen, right? So we need to sort this out.
Semi-classical model simply might not be adequate.
Yeah, but then what do you do in molecules? I'm actually a little bit more optimistic for the field, because then we can pretty much stop, right? Because when you look at all these experiments that are out there and their interpretation, which are based on the semi-classical model applied over and over again, I mean, on much more complicated things than a helium target, right? And we can't even explain helium.
Yeah, that's true, but
this is not detailed. This is 15, 20 degrees. This is not a detail.
It's details. I mean, if you talk about molecules, it's really details.
Molecules have a difficulty. The ionization rate is different, parallel and perpendicular. Much more complicated.
Yes, and if you can't even explain this one, how are you going to do that then with the molecules,
actually,
right?
You
can't solve time-dependent
Schrödinger equation. I mean, if you're doing, for instance, multi-ionization, then it's not sensitive. The system doesn't much care what happens if there is a tunneling time or if there isn't a tunneling time, because it is so short on the scale that we are interested in multi-ionization, it doesn't make any difference whatsoever. And so, yes, you can do in there. Amazing model.
But you know, I definitely still want to say in principle, the approximation that in the interpretation of the data goes in is the parabolic, it's the static, and if we take into account all non-adiabatic, we still get this offset. So, you know, I'm still, you know, I think there is still some discussion between time-dependent Schrödinger equation, because the first data points that we got from Skrinci, they were not on. They were somewhere in between, and they moved, obviously, in between. So I don't know what you guys are doing, right?
No, I cannot judge. It's published nearly a year ago, and we calculate exactly the same offset angle. No any analysis of time delay. We just compare angles with angles. And Armin just produced our data, basically. Better quality.
It's relatively well defined, the discrepancy by now, right?
Okay, so we should sort this out, right? Because
how
we need
can
to.
We sort it out? I don't know.
As I said, can you solve it
for
helium?
Solve it for helium.
You cannot solve helium exactly.
You're doing exactly right now, which is prevention.
At what wavelengths?
You can drive helium by XUV, no problem. With one full of XUV. Of the infrared.
That's easier.
But not 800 nanometers.
But it's still too much on both lines and it's not a chip. It's
But not
in all directions. I mean, both directions.
Okay.
You can do some approximation to go beyond the electron. So if you would do any approximation.
I mean, I don't believe that the tunneling time is zero. I mean, I'm sorry. No way.
No way, okay.
I mean, tunneling time is zero, I have a problem with as an experimentalist, okay? I mean, fundamentally. If this is really true, I mean, I'm definitely going to keep doing measurements. I mean, I don't believe you're...
Can I suggest something very simple?
I mean, no way.
Yeah. Okay, maybe later.
Maybe we should...
Yeah, let me tell you.
And then it will be time for coffee. We can have
even discussion. And then there's dinner.
Yes.
Tunneling time zero. This is no way, guys. Okay. But, you know, there is another side effect from the Feynman path integral because, you know, our data is in principle in agreement with two theory, the Larmor time and the Feynman path integral, right? So you basically talk to Sasha because this is also something beautiful because it is in agreement. This would actually mean that there is a distribution, that there is an uncertainty when a hole is exactly made. I mean, we all know zeta bounds hole response because the electron is are fermions, and if you have multiple electrons and you pull out one electron out, the other electrons will react to a missing electron, and there is a so-called 50 attosecond typical fundamental time constant of this rearrangement. This would be another fundamental time constant to the whole creation because of the tunneling process is a distribution. Basically, there is not an exact time when a hole is created when you tunnel ionize. And this can be pretty significant, right?
There's no hole in helium, but I think it's still true that it, you know, has some relaxation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but this one is not, this one has not to do with the relaxation of the fermion bath. This one is something inherent to the Feynman path, and she will tell you because there is a distribution of this one. And you know, one of the things I would like to show with experiments to show this time constant in the whole creation.
Can you do this Feynman path integral analysis for your cover potential? Not for Coulomb potential, just for your Yukawa potential.
Yes, I mean, you can do it for any potential. It's
and then for your Yukawa potential, it shows exactly there is no time delay at all because the tilt angular offset is zero. Armin Skrinza showed his data.
So you guys really need to talk, right? She is here for many weeks. So I really, really have to encourage you to talk because, you know, this is beyond me. She is the expert.
The big problem is when you solve a QDS, how can you find time periods away from
answer this or not? We don't know.
Because I bring you more. I bring you more to discuss. Hey, I bring you more now. Okay, I showed you the quality of our data is actually not bad, right? We are reproducible data. In different labs, we're comparing, we're getting the same data. Now we need the theories to agree, right, guys? So we need more agreement on theory. This is my wish as an experimentalist. And actually, what approximation do we agree on? We need as a community some kind of common thing, not that I get my papers rejected on some assumptions that are okay on the other paper, right? Because that's what is actually right now happening. And let me give you another one, which is gonna get your attention. We actually just showed the breakdown of the electric dipole approximation a la Rice, right? Everybody knows Howard Rice. So let me show you our experiment, huh? Just to keep you guys even more entertained, right? Because I'm actually enjoying this life as an experimentalist. So, you know, here we're going in with actually mid-IR laser light, 3.4 micrometer. And again, we go into a VMIS, and again, we go into simple atom target, right? And what basically you all know, the dipole approximation is something that many of us use. Huh? And there are the two limits when you have it as a function. This is the Howard Rice diagram that you all know and for sure love, right? There is the so-called green area, which is the island of okay dipole approximations, which is called the dipole oasis, according to Howard Rice. The upper dipole limit is normally easy to understand, because if you make the wavelengths shorter and shorter so that it is comparable to your target, then the dipole approximation is not valid anymore, because you neglect the spatial dependence of your electromagnetic field. But there is another limit, which is basically this magnetic displacement, because if you neglect the spatial dependence of your electric field or vector potential, that means that the magnetic field that acts is also zero. And, you know, this is the regime where we normally neglect in all our semi-classical model the interaction with the magnetic field, right, in the streaking. So in 3.4 at moderate intensities, which we just achieved with our laser development, we keep pushing up the energy so that I also can do the auto clock then with 3.4 micron, it will come. We're pushing it into this theoretical prediction from Howard Rice, where this where the dipole approximation will break down. So what experiment did we do? We ionized a gas target. As I will show you, this applies to all our gas targets. So we look at the momentum distribution from the VMIS, and we look at the electrons just around the center. These are the electrons that are ionized by actually the field of your VMIS. So these are normally the ones that that don't get the ionization distribution. These are kind of at the momentum of the ion. If we integrate the electron distribution here at higher momentum, then we can actually see a displacement, an offset. And this offset basically depends on the electric field and goes into the opposite direction than the pressure, the light pressure. And if we do this offset as a function of intensity for helium, neon, argon, xenon, this, we can get here a systematic offset on all of these atoms. And the gray would be the explanation, taking into account the magnetic field in the streaking. Okay? And this paper is now also on archive, so you can look at it. We submitted it to PRL and is under review. And we can actually explain this offset with this additional magnetic field effect, which basically would be in agreement to this other limit of the dipole. That basically means that if you go to longer and longer wavelengths in your electromagnetic field, you might want to be careful in the semi-classical model that you use, and you can't just simply assume that you can neglect the magnetic field. Even at moderate intensities, you know, these are basically below 10 to the 14 watt per square centimeter. which makes life again more complicated if this is really true and we agree on all of this. So as you can see, I think you know, we keep doing measurements. We need better agreement between the theoreticians, and yeah, I think it just shows how exciting this field is. Thank you very much.
I would return to previous slide. Actually, I did time-dependent Schrödinger equation, and I see this offset. But now I see also radiation pressure. You see also, because radiation pressure measure, you should average PZ calculate. You have a distribution, calculate average PZ. And there are tails. Actually, it's like radiation pressure.
But it's in the opposite direction.
No. My PZ is right. Look at your wings, right wings. I suggest you calculate PZ, not offset. One can do both. I have exactly something similar to you from my time dependence. What I did more, I calculate average PZ over this distribution or nice to one. And I see radiation pressure because of the wings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's not asymmetric. Yeah. Yeah.
Because of this, I see exactly what we expect for pressure.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And this offset here, and it
offset is like you, yeah.
Also like this.
Yeah. So in this case, TDSC agrees with you roughly.
But in the TDSC, do you have the magnetic fields included and so on?
Of course not. Otherwise, it's zero, otherwise, offset is zero.
Aha, okay.
But I agree with you. Here is non-dipole effect as in TDSC.
Ah, okay. And did you publish this?
One is submitted without the, for circular we submitted, and this we are preparing.
Oh, good. So let's keep in touch, because that would be nice as an additional confirmation. Okay, great.
Other question?
Thanks.
I have a comment about dipole approximation. They're all experts here, so maybe they can resolve this question that I want to raise. May I go to the blackboard for a short time?
So maybe I'll stay over here.
So what is the meaning of dipole approximation before I check my field construction? And here I'm doing it after I drop the radiation construct the field. It's not zero. The magnetic field is not zero. This is E and this is B. So this is E and this is B. Both of them.
So it is KR is negligible.
No, that is not. That is also an important point. So here, let me keep them as it is. You see, K vector is equal to omega by C in magnitude. So
So this you can write the same omega by c with unit vector of a. So it is not zero, it is zero. If I take my limiting momentum, retardation momentum zero before I construct it. But it is not zero if I take the dipole limit, retardation momentum zero, after I have constructed the field. So this whole business here, that it is zero if I make the dipole absorption, is a consequence of making the k zero before I have constructed the field. So we have a very common idea that make dipole absorption field disappears. But do it after you've constructed the field, so the limiting process is not unique. And this is the point I want to raise. Yes.
But you still need it in another direction.
Pardon?
You need to have it in the perpendicular direction.
It is in the perpendicular direction, the cross product.
Yeah, so you still have to calculate it. But it's a separate calculation, it's a separate operator in your Hamiltonian.
In dipole approximation, these fields are existing. Non-zero B field, that's what I'm trying to say. If I make the approximation after I have constructed the field, there is no particular direction to this.
But it's symmetric with respect to K in both directions, but here it says isymmetric.
No, I'm not talking about the experiment, I'm talking about dipole approximation, the concept that three theoreticians are using and dropping the magnetic field all the time. And constructing such a domain so it is valid and non-valid, it depends on the assumption that I drop the retardation in there before I have constructed the field.
Sure.
Yeah. I can do this and I can show that it is non-zero. In fact, this B field will have an effect on the activities of electron motion. In dipole approximation.
But if in atomic units, the magnitude of R is about one, then the K here
small. No, K is omega over C.
Yeah, that's small.
And here is also
is
omega over C. It's not small. What is small is not the field, it's the force that is small. You see, the force is small because it is something like E plus B by C cross B or B. So it is this thing that makes the contribution of B field small, not the B small.
But the coupling with the atom is smaller with a factor of C.
Yes, that is true. But and what is the field is not zero, that we have an effect, small effect.
But it will have
this
effect.
This effect is
But you have to take, I mean, the reason you don't take it into account is more for work.
Of course it's not work. I'm not worried about that. I'm worried about the concept of base.
Are there any other questions?
I mean, you know, I actually, you know, as an experimentalist, I have a wish. Because, you know, I mean, every time we bring up something and we bring it to one theoretician, I get one opinion, and then I go to another theoretician, I get another opinion. I would like to, you know, the problem with autosecond science right now is that we don't have a textbook. I mean, this is really a challenge. And I know that some of the more senior people are in the process of writing a textbook, and I mean, Anne Lullier is kind of in the process, I mean, with Levenstein, I think. We should all ask her. I mean, it would be nice to get some textbooks, because, you know, there's more and more people coming in this field in autosecond science, and it would really help the overall progress if we would have some textbooks where we say, okay, we agree on this one. We have here some discussions, you know, and because, you know, depending on who you have as a reviewer, you know, you have one from this side or from this side. Excuse me?
I want to comment on this, because I commented last week when there was another discussion about the experimentalist was wrong, and I said we perhaps calculate the same thing, that's why we agree, but we don't agree with the experimentalist. But I think, I mean, this is... This is a little bit a wrong attitude towards theory to say that I want you to give the same results, because the same answer, because of course it depends on when you have something which you don't know what to do, and you don't know exactly how to do it, and then you make approximations, then it's an opinion before you made the calculation, if the approximation is valid or not.
Right.
And the thing which was discussed a lot here was many body effects. Is this, can this be affected by this relaxation, for example? You brought up yourself, and and then this is a question of belief. I mean, is this in helium or argon possible that the many body effects are of this magnitude? And everybody knows that many body effects are something we just can do approximations for. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, we do different. And of course, I mean, when Anatoly and we made the same approximations, or did we have different programs, then we get the same results. Mm-hmm. As you do, you and Anne, you have different machines, but you make the same measurements. You do it carefully, you get the same results. This just shows that we don't have big numerical problems. We are just making the same approximation, and we agree on that's appropriate. We do the approximation right. But what we didn't put in is very hard to say something about, since you haven't calculated. You have to. This is a hard skill to be able to predict the size of what you didn't put in. This is one thing. The other thing is that sometimes one might see something which is not what you expect to see, some new effect. So you say it's one effect, and then everybody calculates this effect and say this can't be that. And then but it might be a third effect. I mean, something which you didn't think about. It doesn't mean that anybody
is wrong. You just have to give us more time, and I think you have to give yourself more time, right? I mean, if you complain that you're not taken seriously outside, then I would say just don't publish things so fast, or just publish it in a different way. Just these are facts, and I don't call it tunneling time. I wait until we have substantiated that. This
getting copies and letting them evolve in time, right? I mean, to a certain extent, it is also normal scientific progress, right?